Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 263 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, I'm going to be talking about a topic that I consider to be very high yield for all the USMLE exams, Step 1, Step 2, CK, Step 3. You'll very likely find one or more questions on this on an exam, right? So, you know, God willing, we're going to be talking about CNS infections today. We'll just talk about them in different ways and highlight the different ways they're tested. And again, I will try to not just give you facts. I'll try to give you some understanding where necessary as to, like, you know, some kind of pathophysiology so that you understand what's going on. And again, as a reminder, if you're taking Step 2 CK anytime soon, you may want to participate in the trifecta course I'm doing from Monday to Wednesday, right? So on Monday, we meet from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific time. We'll go over NBME test taking strategies. And then on Tuesday and Wednesday from noon to 5 p.m. Pacific time, we'll meet and cover high yield topics. We cover about 800 vignettes across peds, surgery, OB-GYN, IM, neuro, and psych. So if that's something you're interested in, just shoot me an email through the website and then we'll go from there. Okay. So what if they give you a question about a patient and, you know, they tell you that this patient is an IV drug user and, you know, this patient, over the last year has lost 40 pounds of weight. And then they tell you that this patient, you know, has been having severe headache, nuchal rigidity for the last 3 days, has very high fevers, right? And then they give you CSF studies and you notice that the protein count is really high. You notice that the CSF opening pressure is amazingly high. It's 300. This bug I'm about to talk about now loves to cause amazing CSF pressures, right? And then they tell you that this person has very low glucose, let's say glucose is 10, right? And an increased white cell count with a preponderance of lymphocytes. If you see that, I really hope and they ask for your next best step in diagnosis. I really hope you want to perform a lumbar puncture, right? And with that lumbar puncture fluid, you want to send it off for the latex particle agglutination assay, right? And I mean, if they don't put that as an answer choice, you can subject this to the India ink stain. I would hope with that you're thinking about Cryptococcus neoformans, right? Remember, Cryptococcus, right, is pretty much one of the most common causes of meningitis in HIV patients, right? And remember, if you want to treat, don't forget, you give the person amphotericin B and flucytosine to get them over the hump. So amphotericin B and flucytosine to get them over the hump. And then for a few months afterwards, they need to be on fluconazole prophylaxis. It's usually the months varies, but let's just say somewhere between 6 to 12 months, right? You want to put them on fluconazole prophylaxis to decrease the risk of recurrence, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, you know, was recently started on highly active antiretroviral therapy, right? And this patient has been over the last... that initially, you know, his CD4 count was 55, right? And, you know, they noticed that over the last 2-3 days, he has been having generalized tonic-clonic seizures, right? And then they tell you that an EEG is largely unremarkable, but that they obtain brain imaging and they find calcifications around the caudate and putamen and things like that. And they ask for your next best step in management. I would really, really hope that you're thinking of... giving that person pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine, right? This person has toxoplasmosis. Remember, if your CD4 count is less than 100, right, you want to go ahead and give that person TMPSMX to prophylax against Toxoplasma gondii, right? Remember, it's a protozoan, right? So it loves to usually classically presents as ring-enhancing lesions on our brain imaging, right, in a HIV patient. And don't forget, right, it loves to cause calcifications in the brain, especially in the basal ganglia, right? So if they tell you that you see a HIV patient and this person has calcifications around the caudate, the putamen, right, the globus pallidus and things like that, right? Then I would really hope that you're thinking about toxoplasmosis under those circumstances. And again, remember, prophylaxis against toxo is different from prophylaxis it's different from treatment for toxo, right? It's different from treatment for toxo, right? So toxo prophylaxis, right? You use trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. Toxo treatment, you use pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine, right? Although if the person is pregnant, right, then you cannot give pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine. Those are antifolate agents, right? That would not be very prudent, right? It's not like you were trying to give the child a neurotube defect here. So in those circumstances, usually the smart prudent thing to do is to give spiramycin. You give spiramycin in those circumstances. And one thing I want to say is whenever you're giving a person pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine, this is actually one of those bizarre questions they can throw in your exam. You want to go ahead and add leucovorin to that treatment regimen, right? So that those people do not get bone marrow suppression, right? So you give those people pyrimethamine, sulfadiazine, and you give them the folinic, not folic, folinic acid analog in leucovorin. And I think I may have misspoken earlier, right? So in terms of the calcification patterns, I was just trying to make a contrast between Toxoplasma gondii and CMV in terms of congenital infection, right? So remember, CMV loves to cause calcifications around the lateral ventricles, right? So it causes those periventricular calcifications. Contrast this with Toxo that loves to cause, again, calcifications in the basal ganglia, right? Again, caudate. So this is for congenital infection. So my apologies with the misspeaker earlier, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, you know, this patient is like a pig farmer, right? And, you know, that sometimes his child plays in with the pigs and all that stuff. And then they tell you that this child has been having like seizures and that, you know, he's had seizures like he had like a seizure like 3 weeks ago, had another seizure like a month ago, right? And then they tell you that at his pediatrician visit, they notice that 3 months ago, his heart circumference was in the 30th percentile, but now it's in the 97th percentile. If you see that, what should you be thinking about? I would really hope you're thinking about tineus solium, right? This person literally has cystic sarcosis, right? So remember, tineus solium, typically, if you consume like food or water, right, that has been exposed to eggs of this nasty booger, right, of the tapeworm, right, like these are tapeworms, right, the person can rapidly get in trouble, right? So again, if you see any pig association, think about cystic sarcosis, right? And again, many times, right, essentially the thing that will happen with these bugs is they will keep growing in the brain, right? And then they will form all these cysts that are calcified, right? That's why you can see them on imaging. And many times these cysts can ultimately lead to a person having seizures, person having like a big brain, right? So they can have like some kind of hydrocephalus, right? And again, because it's a warm infection, right, you're going to give those people bendazole, right? So you give them like albendazole, thiabendazole, right, mebendazole, stuff like that, right? So you give them those bendazoles and you give them a steroid, right? You give them a steroid to try to reduce their seizures and also kind of calm down the inflammation. And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient, comes into he was found down at home, right? He was comatose, right? And they tell you that he has a very, that he's poorly, okay, let me not say comatose, but he's poorly responsive. He's complaining of like severe facial pain, right? And, you know, they tell you that his medical history is unknown, right? But that he takes, insulin every day, right? And then you notice that his glucose is like 465 and his bicarb is like 14, right? And then again, they tell you that he's complaining of severe facial pain. He has a very high fever, powerful leukocytosis. If you see this, I would really hope you're thinking about mucormycosis, right? I hope you're thinking about mucormycosis, right? Especially like those are rhizobacter species, right? Those rhizobacter species, remember, it can cause like, it usually basically causes infection that starts in the frontal sinuses and then they can spread to the brain, especially the frontal lobe, right? Frontal sinuses, direct shot to the frontal lobe, right? So those things can ultimately cause problems, right? And again, for these people, unfortunately, you need to debride extensively, right? And then give amphotericin B and then pray for the best outcome. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a patient? You know, they tell you that the patient, you know, is like a swim instructor, right? So this patient is a swim instructor and this patient, they notice that over the last 2 days, right, this person has been having like fevers, right? This person is somnolent, right? And then they tell you that this person then dies 2 days afterwards, right? If you see this, I would really hope you're thinking about Naegleria fowleri, right? Remember, Naegleria, it's spelled like Naegleria, right? Naegleria fowleri, right? Remember, this thing loves to cause problems, especially in people that swim in fresh water, right? So they won't say the patient went swimming in fresh water, right? That'll be too easy on an exam. What they will do is they will give you some water association, right? And then begin to lead you there. They'll probably give you like an answer that says leptospirosis or like some weird stuff, right? Don't fall for those things. Think about Naegleria fowleri. See a person exposed to water and they die very rapidly. Think about a Naegleria fowleri. And again, this thing is pretty fatal, right? But One thing you can do in terms of treatment is you can give amphotericin B and again hope for the best. And again, it loves to torch a person's frontal lobes in their brain, right? So again, just one of those extra tidbits you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient recently immigrated to the US, you know, like 10 days ago. It's like an exchange student, right? And they tell you that this patient has been somnolent for a couple of days. He came to the US, he was fine initially, but he's been somnolent. They can even make this one of these military questions, where it will be a person that has been deployed to like an African country, right? And then they tell you that this person has been somnolent, is always sleepy, right? And this patient is refusing food, losing a ton of weight, right? If you see this, I would really, really want you to think about sleeping sickness, right? Remember, sleeping sickness, it occurs when a person gets some trypanosomal problems, right? So remember, like, the big thing you want to remember is trypanosoma brucei, right? So B-R-U-C-E-I, right? So these are trypanosomal species, they can cause problems, right? And remember that they are transmitted by the CC fly, right? By the CC fly. Again, remember, they love testing vectors on exams, right? It's just one of those things you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? So basically, right, so how does this thing cause issues, right? Pretty much the thing that happens is, you know, the person will get infected, right? And usually it's a bloodborne infection initially, right? And then over time, those bugs will find a way to get to the brain, right? And the thing is, you may wonder, like, Divine, why is this thing called sleeping sickness, right? Like, why do these people sleep? The thing is, apparently, these bugs that cause sleeping sickness, they actually release, like, some chemicals in the brain, right? That actually cause a person to just fall asleep, right? So that's actually why it's called sleeping sickness to start with. And again, typically, in terms of treatment, you can give these people like pentamidine, right? Remember, pentamidine is also one of those things we can use to treat pneumocystis jirovetsi. But you can also give them another drug known as melarsoprol, right? So M-E-L-A-R-S-O-P-R-O-L, right? So you can give them melarsoprol or you can give them pentamidine, right? So you can give them melarsoprol or you can give them pentamidine. And I mean, typically, if you want to make a diagnosis, right, you can, you know, do a lumbar puncture, get some CSF. And you'll notice, especially if it's like acute infection, they will have like elevated IgM against these trypanosomal species in their CSF, right? And again, maybe like, Divine, why are these people refusing food? Again, for whatever reason, if you ever see a person that dies of sleeping sickness, they die because they just don't eat, right? Starvation, believe it or not, is actually one of the most common causes of death in these people that have a trypanosomal sleeping sickness, right? So for whatever reason, these people just refuse food, right? And then they ultimately die, right? Again, usually people don't die of this stuff, but if they die, it's because they just did not eat, pretty much. If not, it's very treatable, right? Again, pentamidine, or you can give a melarsoprol, okay? So it's something to remember for purposes of exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, right? And they tell you that this patient, you know, comes in the, like, July, right? And this patient has been having, like, mental status abnormalities, right? They perform a lumbar puncture, right? And you notice that, you know, the CSF has, roughly normal glucose, normal opening pressures. The white count is just a little elevated, and it's, like, 90% lymphocytes. And they ask you, like, what's the next best step in management of this patient? I would really hope you're picking the answer that says supportive care, right? This person has some kind of viral meningitis, right? And if they're trying to get you to pick a specific bug that's causing this viral meningitis, I want you to think about like an enterovirus infection, right? Remember, enterovirus loves to cause viral meningitis. In fact, it's the most common cause of viral meningitis on USMLE exams, right? So something to watch out for, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient, right? And they tell you that this patient, you know, again, IV drug user, has HIV, CD4 counts is like 40, right? And they tell you that, again, he has been somnolent over the last couple of days, right? Somnolent over the last couple of days. And then they tell you that, again, they obtain CSF studies, right? And again, you notice that opening pressure is normal, glucose is roughly normal. And again, remember, CSF glucose is not the same thing as the body's glucose. Just something I think I maybe should draw your attention to. So normal body glucose is, you know, right around 100, right? But normal CSF glucose is actually between like 50 to 70, 75 roughly, right? So again, it's a little lower than what is normal, right? So don't say, oh, their CSF glucose is 60 and it's abnormal. It's really not. It's actually normal, right? So, you know, so you notice that, you know, this person, again, normal CSF opening pressure, normal protein, normal glucose, slightly elevated white count, predominantly lymphocytes. And then they give you like the red blood cells, and they show you like 0 to 5 per high power field. So almost no red blood cells, right? I would hope if you see that, that you're not thinking about herpes, right? With a person that has this really low CD4 count number, I would really hope you're thinking about Coxsackie virus. I mean, sorry, I would really hope you're thinking about CMV, right? Again, remember, CMV loves to go after people that have HIV, right? But you may say, Divine, how do I differentiate this from herpes? I already gave you one factor there. People that have herpes meningitis on NBM exams, right? You will tend to find a lot of red blood cells in their CSF on lumbar puncture, right? You may say, okay, Divine, how do I differentiate this from Cryptococcus? People that have Cryptococcus, they'll have similar labs in terms of elevated white counts, tons of lymphocytes, but the opening pressures will be very high, the glucose will be very low, and the protein will be very high, right? So that's how you differentiate those, right? So if you're seeing like a viral style picture in terms of the CSF findings, and you don't see many red blood cells, and you're, again, you're noticing that this person is like CD4 count in the doldrums, right? Like less than 50 kind of deal. I want you to think about CMV, right? Think about CMV. And again, don't forget CMV, they may ask you many different questions on the exam. They can ask you an easy question like treatment, right? Remember, you want to give those people like ganciclovir or valganciclovir, right? But remember, if you don't see those as answers, or they've tried those and it's not working, right? Go ahead and give that person foscarnet, right? Remember, foscarnet is that pyrophosphate analog, right? Because remember, drugs like acyclovir, ganciclovir, and stuff like that, right? Those things need activation by a kinase to start working, right? But foscarnet does not require activation. It's already a phosphate, right? It's already been phosphorylated, right? So there's a very low threshold for it. There's very high threshold for resistance with foscarnet, right? So that's what you give to people that have like herpes that's or CMV that's resistant to the standard therapy, right? So again, you can give this person a foscarnet, right? And again, remember, they can also ask you like, oh, which of the following is most likely the most likely finding on like CSF studies or whatever, right? Remember, you'll find cells, right, that have these intranuclear inclusions, right? That's the Al's eye nucleus, right? Again, they won't see Al's eye nucleus in the exam. That'll be too easy, right? They'll put intranuclear inclusions, right? So something you want to watch out for in exams. And again, like I said, toxo, right, again, loves to cause calcifications in the brain in the congenital case. But toxo causes calcifications. It can cause calcifications all through the cortex, right? Or if they want to get specific on you on exams, again, it can kind of cluster around the caudates, the putamen, basically parts of your basal ganglia, right? Or, you know, around like your thalamus area, right? But again, if they tell you that a person has calcifications around the ventricles, you want to think more along the lines of a congenital CMV, okay? You want to think more along the lines of congenital CMV. And again, like I said, if a person has herpes meningitis, right? Again, remember, it tends to involve the temporal lobes. They can show you imaging, right? And the way to know that you're dealing with the temporal lobes on imaging on an NBM exam is you'll see the brainstem in that cross-section, right? You'll see the brainstem. If you're seeing the brainstem and you're seeing some part of the cortex, the part of the cortex you are very likely looking at is temporal lobe, especially if it's part of the cortex that is flanking the brainstem on either side, right? And again, if you see a lot of white, right, or whatever, you're just like, this temporal lobe does not look very similar to the temporal lobe on the other side, right? Just one of the great things with radiology, right? We have two of most things in the body, right? So compare both, right? If you're seeing that one doesn't look as good as the other, right? Then you're like, that's a little worrisome, right? So you want to begin to think about a temporal lobe encephalitis with HSV. Again, remember, HSV loves to cause, again, a ton of red blood cells in the CSF, right? Ton of red blood cells in the CSF. And remember that HSV, again, you're going to treat it with IV. You're going to treat those people with like IV, acyclovir, right? You're going to treat those people with IV acyclovir, right? And again, don't forget your temporal lobes. Don't forget all those high yield associations there, right? And then one other thing, right? I guess since we're kind of talking about viruses here that I can mention, right? Remember, people can also get rabies, right? I talked about this a fair amount in my vaccine podcast. By the way, that's a high yield podcast to know if you're taking the USML exams, especially step 2C and step 3. But remember that rabies, right? Again, it's one of these things that can cause is a virus, right? It can cause a CSF problem, right? I mean, it can cause a brain infection, right? And again, remember, people usually get this from some kind of animal bite, right? So we're bitten by a raccoon or a dog or a bat or a skunk or a coyote, something like that, right? You get bit by any of those things, right? The thing is the virus, right? It will basically get to the neuromuscular junction, right? That's its first point of call, right? It will bind to the acetylcholine receptor, get into the neuromuscular junction, and then from there, it will get into, it will replicate around the neuromuscular junction, and then it will use a retrograde transport to go through the neurons, right? Go through the neurons, and then go all the way, right, to the person's brain. And once it gets to the person's brain, the person is pretty much gone. I mean, like, it is 100% fatal once it gets to your brain, right? So that's why when a person has rabies, right, remember, you want to go ahead and give them the rabies immunoglobulin. And again, don't forget, you want to inject it right into the wound, right, so that it can bind up as much of the organism as possible, right? So give them the rabies immunoglobulin, right? And then you need to give the person the vaccine, right, at the same time. But again, give it in a contralateral extremity. You don't want the immunoglobulin to bind up the vaccine, right? And then the vaccine does not work, right? So again, give the immunoglobulin into the wound and then give the vaccine into a different extremity, right? That's very important to know, right? And again, remember the classic telltale sign that a person has gotten like rabies in the brain and they're pretty much about to die, right? Is these people, right, they wouldn't want to drink water, right? So if you see a person that has flaccid paralysis, refusing water on an NBM exam, right? Think about rabies, right? Think about rabies. Because basically, right, like the person's throat muscles are becoming spastic, right? So they're beginning to reject fluid, right? So that's why those people, don't want water. They don't want to do any, they don't want anything with water inside their throats. And then don't forget that if they tell you that, oh, the person dies, and then they will say, oh, which of the four is the most likely biopsy finding, right? Again, don't forget, right? You'll find pink intracytoplasmic inclusions, right? So again, remember in CMV, right, when cytomegalovirus, you're going to find intranuclear inclusions, right? But in rabies, right, you're going to find intracytoplasmic inclusions, right? Intracytoplasmic inclusions, right? Intracytoplasmic inclusions. Remember, those are the things that are known as Negri bodies, right? Negri bodies. Again, all these little details. The thing is, step 2CK is slowly becoming it's not a matter of slowly becoming, but, I mean, you've probably heard of the program director poll a few weeks ago, right, where step 2CK is now the most important thing they consider in a person's application, even over step 1 scores, right? So the thing is, you hear experiences of people, right, that, oh, they're taking step 2CK and they're seeing, like, some of these, like, little step 1 basic science details, right? I suspect that step 2CK will begin to go more in that direction for the foreseeable future, right? So again, just something you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams, right? Just something to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And then in terms of the spinal cord, right, don't forget polio, right? Remember, there is a vaccine against it, right, that prevents that. So this will likely be an immigrant style question, right? And the person will have, like, muscle paralysis. And, you know, really, unfortunately, there's no treatment, right? You could have prevented it by getting the vaccine. I remember that the polio virus loves to go after the ventral horn, right? You may see it referred to as the anterior horn of the spinal cord, right? So it causes predominantly low motor neuron problems, right? So again, just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? And then what if they give you a question about, like, a newborn, right? And you tell you that this newborn, was born 2 days ago, whatever, right? And this person has, like, this newborn has, like, nuchal rigidity, very high fevers, and all that stuff, right? And septic, right? I would hope you're thinking about group B strep, right? Strep A galactiae, right? Remember, it's the most common cause of meningitis in the first 28 days of life, right? Which is what is defined as the neonatal period, right? And again, in terms of treatment, for the most part, these kids, just go ahead and give them you can give them, like, a third generation cephalosporin, right? So you can give them something like ceftriaxone. But if you don't see that as an answer, you know, you can give ampicillin, right? Ampicillin is fine for treating a group B strep, strep A galactiae, right? And again, they can ask you, which of the following is the most likely source of infection in this kid, right? You want to think about the maternal vagina, right? Remember, this is why we screen women that are pregnant between the ages of 35 to 37, right? 35 to 37 weeks gestation, we screen for group B strep, right? And then again, another thing you may see, right, again, if they give you, like, that, this kind of picture, right, like first 20 days of life meningitis, and they don't put strep A galactiae as an answer, right, then the next answer you should be looking for is E. coli, right? Remember, E. coli is the second most common cause of meningitis, right, in newborns, right, again, in first 20 days of life. And E. coli, for the most part, give those kids a third-gen cephalosporin, right? So give something like ceftriaxone or cefotaxime, right, or ceftazidime. That's absolutely fine. But again, let's assume group B strep is not an answer. E. coli is not an answer. And the answer we want to pick is Listeria, right? Remember, Listeria is the third most common cause of meningitis in a newborn, right? And again, Listeria, the drug of choice for treating Listeria is ampicillin, right? I'll say that again. The drug of choice for treating Listeria, right, is ampicillin. Remember, Listeria is that thing that, you know, again, if mom is exposed to like deli meats, hot dogs, soft cheeses, and all that stuff, right? She can get Listeria and transmit it to the baby, right? And remember that that thing can cause granulomas all across the body of the fetus, right? Like that's the thing called a granulomatosis infantiseptica, right? But again, treat Listeria with ampicillin on an MBME exam, right? And then if they give you a question about a person that has meningitis, right? And you see this person, you know, has meningitis and has skin findings, right? So this person has like petechiae or purpura or whatever on the skin, you want to think about meningococcal meningitis, right? From Neisseria meningitidis, right? And again, Neisseria meningitidis, remember you treat this with third-gen cephalosporin, again, like ceftriaxone, for example. But you don't just treat the patient, you need to treat their close contacts, right? You can use ceftriaxone, you can use rifampin, you can use ciprofloxacin, right? Of all those three agents, remember the one that is actually the most preferred, believe it or not, is rifampin, right? But obviously, if the person is pregnant, that was a close contact, right? You clearly cannot give rifampin, right? You clearly cannot give ciprofloxacin to a pregnant woman, right? So the drug of choice in that case will be ceftriaxone, right? And remember that if a person has one thing, I guess, let me just go ahead and say now, because they can, I can totally see the MBME going after this on exams. Remember that if you want to protect a person, let's say you're a healthcare worker, right? And the person is going to be working with patients that have TB, or is going to be going into a potential TB environment or potential COVID-19 environment, then those people need to be placed on they need to get respirators, right? They need to get an N95 mask, right? That's very important to know. It's just one of those weird, bizarre things that you see on the newer MBME exams. I just thought I should pretty much draw that to your attention, right? And one thing I will say for sure is if you see a meningitis question, right, Neisseria meningitidis will classically, again, cause meningitis with skin findings, right? Again, classically will cause meningitis with skin findings, right? And then don't forget, right, strep pneumo is another bug that can cause a meningitis, right? Again, they will tell you the person has meningitis. You check their CSF because it's a bacterial infection, right? You'll find low glucose, high CSF protein, right? Ton of white blood cells, but it'll be neutrophils you'll find, right? You'll find a ton of neutrophils, right? And again, the opening pressures will be supremely high, right? You'll be supremely high. And then, you know, they'll tell you to, if you do, they'll show, tell you that, oh, gram stain of bloody, bloody, blah, right? Shows gram positive diplococci, right? If you see stuff like that, right? You want to think about strep pneumo. Remember, if it's Neisseria meningitidis, it'll be gram negative diplococci. And remember that Neisseria meningitidis can be treated with there's actually a vaccine against that, right? There's a vaccine against that, right? So if a person has pneumococcal meningitis, typically what you want to do is you want to give them ceftriaxone, right? And vancomycin, right? I'll say this again. You want to give ceftriaxone and vancomycin, right? But in addition to that, you need to add a steroid, right? To decrease the morbidity associated with the infection, right? So just remember the term CVS, right? Like the pharmacy, right? Ceftriaxone, vancomycin, and a steroid, right? That's how you treat pneumococcal meningitis, right? And then in my TB podcast, right, which I made, I think, like yesterday or 2 days ago, I can't remember which one again, we talked about how TB can cause meningitis, right? But again, even if TB is a bacteria, right, remember, it can cause meningitis in a format where you notice that, wow, the CSF opening pressure is really high, protein is really high, glucose is really low, white cells are elevated. But again, even if it's a bacterial infection, you find a predominance of lymphocytes, not neutrophils. I'll say it again, predominance of lymphocytes, right? Not neutrophils, right? And again, remember that TB, right? If they tell you that, oh, the perform imaging of the brain, and you notice that, oh, there's enhancement at the base of the brain, right? There's enhancement at the base of the brain. Think about TB, right? TB loves to cause hyperintensity at the base of the brain, right? So it's just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And again, for the most part, again, if a person has TB meningitis, right, you're going to give them rifampin, right? Isoniazid, pyrazinamide, and ethambutol, plus vitamin B6. But one other thing I'm going to throw in here is you're going to give them steroids as well, right? You're going to give them steroids. Remember, you give steroids for pneumococcal meningitis, but you also give steroids for TB meningitis, right? And then to wrap up this conversation with like CNS infections. Don't forget, right? Syphilis can cause a bunch of stuff in the CNS, right? Remember, it can cause tibis dorsalis, right? So that's where your dorsal columns are all messed up, right? So you have problems with like fine touch, vibration, proprioception, right? Remember, essentially your dorsal columns are gone, and those people have like a positive Romberg sign, right? And then don't forget that it can also cause like the Argyle Robertson pupil, right? So remember those people, right? Like, it's essentially like a kind of cranial nerve problem, right? Where essentially, right, their pupils, right, they are able to accommodate, right? So they have that good accommodation response, right? But they do not necessarily react to light, right? So they don't have that consensual pupillary response, right? And again, remember, syphilis, we treat it with penicillin, right? We treat syphilis with penicillin. So, you know, hopefully you found this podcast to be helpful. If you listen to this, again, I will be surprised if you're not able to knock out the CNS infection questions you see on your exam. And again, please subscribe to the YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. And then I also have this podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, on Spotify. Please subscribe. Any positive feedback you leave always helps, right? Always helps. And also you can subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. Basically, whenever I make a podcast, you get a notification or something like that, right? So thank you for listening to this podcast. And one thing, I guess, I'll just say in terms of life lessons, is this. It kind of dovetails off of a life lesson I've talked about before, right? It's a very classic saying in where I'm from. So I'm from Nigeria, by the way. And it's this saying that don't count your chickens before they are hatched, right? In fact, there is this pastor that I know. He loves to use this term that you shouldn't share your testimony until it's complete, right? So again, it's just kind of coming off of lessons I've learned from life, right? Don't boast too early, right? Don't share your results too early. Just wait, right? Let that thing come to fruition before you start sharing, right? Because again, if you shared, and that thing ends up not happening, right? Or something weird happens, right? And boom, you're completely knocked off balance, right? If you didn't share, then you don't have any shame to hide, right? But if you shared, then you have a ton of shame to it. People be like, oh, so what happened, right? And then you have to start telling another story, and then sometimes it will lead people to, you know, start lying, right? So that you can still keep essentially keeping up with the Joneses, keep impressing people, right? So again, until something has completely come to an end, you don't need to share it, right? Again, I feel like we live in this generation where people just love to share, like social media, like some people's lives. You can literally catalog, you can literally find out where they live, who they are married to, every part of their lives, how much they have in their bank account, just like going on their social media pages, right? So again, just be smart, be prudent, right? You see how social media can be used to destroy people these days. You can make a post on something, someone picks it up, puts it all over the news, destroys your life, right? So again, just be careful with how much you share, right? Just be wise with your sharing. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I'll see you next time. God bless you. Have a wonderful night and have a great week ahead. Thank you.